Welcome to The Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived, and once again...
It's Aloha Friday, no work till Monday.
Right. And if you haven't hit that subscribe button on iTunes, well, what are you waiting for, man? Come on. Do me a solid. If you subscribe, I'll do you a solid. You'll never miss an episode, ever. TIJ will be waiting for you every Wednesday and Friday morning like a Swiss clock, automatically delivered right to the device of your Schwoss. Doesn't get any better than that, right? Just wherever you want it to get sent, it will send it right over to you, okay? And while you're subscribing on iTunes, and the subscription numbers are getting really high, one of the highest iTunes subscribed podcasts going today, I heard that from very secret sources. But while you're subscribing on iTunes, take a minute and leave us a comment and a five-star rating, like the following Talk is Jericho fans did, right? Thanks for taking the time, Claw's cousin, who said Bruce Dickinson, Paul Stanley, and Frankie Benali are his favorite episodes, so he's a rocker. Well, if you like Bruce, stay tuned. I got some more Maiden coming up for you in about 2 or 3 weeks, another nice surprise. Who else is giving you Maiden like I can, right? How about Stankomaniac? Wow. Loves the Dusty Rhodes impressions that everyone does on my show. Waterwalk, Gordon Boombutts, Basilion, Todd Shore, Mr. Wrestling 17, Lupe Roman, and Real Deal 1027, all like the variety of guests. And I thank you for the great feedback. And that's what we do. Diverse and lots of variety is Talk is Jericho's nomenclature, nom de plume. And hey, Waterwalk, you are right about the sponsors. They're the reason why I get to do this for free for you guys twice a week. So thanks for supporting Talk is Jericho and the sponsors, my amazing Sexy Beast sponsors. Thanks for the 5-star ratings and reviews. And we got a lot of good stuff coming up today. Dean Malenko is going to be here. Kind of a return to form. He was with me a few months ago on the Eddie Guerrero tribute episode with Chavo Guerrero, but this is Dean on his own, and we're not talking about our feud in WCW or his time in WWE. This is early Malenko. We're going to talk about his childhood growing up with his dad, Boris Malenko, who's one of the most feared heels in wrestling history. He's going to tell us what he learned from Boris, traveling around the world with Boris. You hear all about Dean's early career days in Japan, tagging with his brother Joe, what it was like working for All Japan and New Japan Pro Wrestling. He's got stories about Eddie Guerrero, Davey Boy Smith, Stan Hansen. It's kind of a trip back in time with Dean Malenko. The shooter, Dean Malenko, the Iceman, Dean Malenko. But before we get to Dean, we got the return of my cute, beautiful daughters, Cece and Shy Shy, to Talk as Jericho. And they requested to do an interview with me to talk about their new YouTube channel. And they wanted to sit down and explain why you need to go check it out, why your kids need to go check it out. And as always, very cute and hilarious and fun. So to talk about their new YouTube channel, here's Sierra and Cheyenne Irvin. Okay, so there's a new YouTube channel that's sweeping the nation, getting subscribers all across the country. You're signing up for Cece and Shy's vlogs and videos, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
And so what gave you guys the idea to start doing your own YouTube channel?
Well, before, we usually like to watch YouTubers that do Minecraft and mod showcases and vlogs and stuff. And, well, before, we each had our own YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And so I thought, why not make a YouTube channel? At first, got to know the basics. And now we've got like 28, 29 something videos and like 39 subscribers.
How many subscribers?
39.
That's a lot of subscribers.
Yeah, so Sierra was like, I had my own, and I thought like hers, because we did most of our videos together on her channel. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, since I didn't have a lot of my, like I had fan videos, I don't know, but your own
videos. You weren't creating your own.
Yeah, and I was doing, like, I didn't have a lot, so I was just thinking maybe I should join Sierra's because we did way more stuff together on her channel, so.
And thank you for all those people that commented super nicely and gave us and let us and subscribe to our channel. Thank you so much, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, because the subscribers went up after I mentioned on Talk is Jericho, mm-hmm, that you guys had your own channel and asked, mm-hmm, people to subscribe, and you got a whole bunch more subscribers.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people listening right now that watch your videos.
From 23 to 27 and now to 29. So it's a big difference.
That's actually 39. right?
Yeah, 39
subscribers. So what kind of videos do you have up there for people that haven't seen your channel?
We have like we have Minecraft videos. I know a lot of
we have daily
like
vlogs like and challenges.
What are some of the challenges?
Some of the challenges are the Bean Boozled Challenge.
Bean Boozled.
We haven't posted the smoothie challenge yet.
Oh, yeah.
The Bean Boozled Challenge.
And what was the Bean Boozled Challenge?
It's you where you get it. This gross jelly beans, you eat them, and then they're either good flavor or bad flavor. It was really gross.
Yeah.
And yeah,
I hated that one. It's yeah. like you gave me one. It said there was like two brown ones. And
oh,
one
yeah.
of them is chocolate canned pudding and the other one is like a skunk.
No, canned dog food.
I got the, like, one time we played it, remember, with Ash, our brother.
Yeah.
And I got all the bad flavor because Ash, so I got like toothpaste, I got all these bad flavors.
Ones, there's toothpaste, there's a skunk.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
I
one that
I got that one and my breath smelled so mad. Bad.
It's just terrible. That's why I almost threw up. I had to quit playing the game.
Yeah. And I when we were playing it with Ash, after we finished, I was like, I'm just gonna see if I can get chocolate pudding since my bad luck was over after the Bean Boozled, after we did it. And I was like, nope, I got canned dog food again. And nope. And for adults who will be watching this video in the future, because it's not out yet, but it's soon.
Because you're filming this to put on your YouTube channel.
It soon will be, but adults who have, if they have kids, just search capital S-I-S-I, and then the other, like the ands, not the A-N-D, but the other one.
The Ambercell.
And then shy.
C-H-E-Y
with capital C, and then space, and then capital V-L-O-G-S, and then U, and then capital V-I-D-E-O-S, and it should pop up.
Yeah, but if you go to YouTube and just put in C-C-S-I-S-I and the amber sign, ampersand,
it should show up.
And if you want to subscribe, you are welcome to. Just don't put any mean comments or anything that will...
It's a free country. They can, you know.
No, but don't start a fight on the comments. Like, if someone said, I think this video was better. No, I think this video better. And you guys just got into a big fight. That would make me sad. So just try not to do that.
You want people to be friends on this site.
Yeah.
It's a happy site.
Be friendly. You love it. Be friendly. You love it. Love being friendly.
You got any other ideas for future videos that you want to do?
Yeah, next week we're going to do a couple of videos. We're going to do ones called Crazy Jobs. And we're going to try to do some more with our friends. And I like this one comment. Somebody commented, can you please do more videos with your dad? So we'll try to do that. Okay. We'll try to post
the
smoothie challenge.
Do that.
Oh, yeah, the smoothie challenge. You haven't posted that one yet?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I tried to send it from my iPad to the phone, but it only sent 4 minutes of it, so I'm trying to figure that out.
Okay.
So as soon as I do, I'll post that as quick as I can.
And what was the smoothie challenge?
It's where you get, like, five good, five bad ingredients, and you put them into a blender, and you blend them, and you make a smoothie, and you have to drink it.
It's not that hard to say. Blender. Blah, blah, blender.
What was the worst ingredient that you got,
the
Shy?
The worst ingredient that I got, I would say the almonds, everything else was pretty good.
Yeah, you got the pretty good ones. What about you, Susie?
I got the health that I had was
healthy kid.
Ketchup. And the second was probably a raw egg. A raw egg. Ha ha ha.
That was a good one. And my other favorite one that you guys had was the top 10 things to do at a sleepover.
To make a sleepover awesome.
To make a sleepover awesome. That was fun. Which one has the most views out of all your videos?
The cup of water challenge. It has like 159, I believe.
159 views for the cup of water challenge?
Because people search.
Probably because I was
people
in it
search.
The first
no,
time.
People search those and they search cup of water challenge and the yoga challenge and things popped up. Like things that were posted like.
Right.
And then we, our channel would show up and they would watch that. And then it'd be another view after another view after another view.
I really, that we should, like, we should plan, like, a meet and greet or something. Because, like, when we get more, like,
more
subs on YouTube. More subs. And if you're watching this, subscribe right now.
Right now.
So you want to have a meet and greet if you guys when you guys become more famous, like at a store and people would come get your autograph.
Oh yeah, yeah, something like that.
Because I just know that like some little kids who really want to do a video and there's like other kids doing it, I think they would really want to meet them because I think it would be so
their idols.
For them.
Be the one to, will be their idols. Be the one to look up to. Be the one to be inspired by. That's what we want to.
Well, that's
be seen
that's
by.
Good. That's really good.
And I was if we have a meet and greet at all, make sure to bring a pen because you always need your handy pen in case you see us and you want an autograph.
Okay.
Safety pen.
So last thing. So why should people subscribe to your channel?
People
Cece?
should subscribe to our channel because it's great for the kids. We do nothing that's inappropriate, and it's something. It's a cheerful channel, and we try to do what you suggest.
And also a quick channel update that we Minecraft Part 2, Crazy Craft Part 2.
Crazy Craft
is going to be on Sunday.
Okay, so that's the next one is on Sunday.
This
okay.
Sunday, and it's going to be Crazy Craft number 2.
Okay, so tell them one more time what the name of the channel is.
Cece and Shy Vlogs and Videos. I just decided this, but I'm going to try to see if we can get some t-shirts that says, like, Cece and Shy Vlogs and Videos and a pic collage picture I made, and we could put it on there, and we'll put them, like, we'll tell them when they're out in, like, stores or something, and we'll tell you when, we'll give you an update on that later. So, yeah.
Okay. Hopefully they'll make a toy about us. That would be really
cool. Did your own action figures?
Yeah. And then, so, for today's... To get on the five shout-outs today, comment down below. Which person you like better, Sierra or Cheyenne? No hard feelings.
Nah. All right, say goodbye to all your fans.
Bye.
We'll see you all later.
Bye.
Subscribe. Parents, go tell your kids to subscribe. It's a fun channel, right?
Mm-hmm. Plus, we have special guests like Chris Jericho, who's also our dad.
Well, I guess it's our time to leave. Peace out, homie. Peace out.
All right. Peace out with Cece and Shy. Shy, don't forget, it's Cece and Shy Vlogs and Videos on YouTube. Fun channel. Check it out and subscribe if you want to check out more about them. If you've got little daughters or sons, have them watch it as well. Some fun stuff. Just little kids. I love the fact that they got their own YouTube channel, which I didn't even know about. I don't even have a YouTube channel. And they're doing this all on their own. And they're exploring and being creative and telling stories and using, you know, technology to post themselves up there. And like I said, I was very, very proud of them. And it's cool to hear them. Maybe they will do private public appearances for you guys. You can come tell them that they're an inspiration. Maybe we'll work on getting some Cece and Shy Shy t-shirts as well. So thanks to Cece and Shy Shy. Go check it out. Cece and Shy Vlogs and Videos on YouTube. Go subscribe to it and boost their numbers. 39. Not a bad bunch of people watching, but let's see if we can get that up to 50 or maybe even 100. They'll be bursting with joy. So,
talk is Jericho.
All right, man. Here in the studio with my old friend Dean Malenko. That's you.
That's me
talking about you. And it's funny. I was driving over here listening to the
segment. Hold on a second.
What?
20-year friendship, been up and down the road each other, beat each other up, done everything together. That's my lead-in. Are you kidding me?
one of the greatest friends I've ever had in the wrestling business. We've been through so much together. You caught me in the bushes one day. We used to go hang out at different various places of ill repute back in the old days. We used to hang out with all of our old friends, and we had some amazing matches, probably the best series of matches I ever had in WCW, and also had a great time at a Leonard Skinner concert, my old friend Dean Stinko Malenko.
Stinko Malenko.
Is that better?
Much better. Much better.
People still call you that?
You know what? Once in a while. Actually, my kids do.
Really?
But for various reasons.
Do they have any reason why?
No, not really.
Call you that?
Not really. That's lasted about 20 years. Every once in a while, I'll still get... somebody out there still refer me as Stinko Malenko.
Stinko Malenko, Dino Machino.
Dino Machino. That definitely stuck.
Well, I was thinking, look, driving over here today, I was listening to the 70s channel, and I still was thinking about that time when, I think of one of the road trips we did, you bought like the best of the 70s, and it was like this six-disc set. And it was like, let's just listen to all of the songs with our old friend Brian Hildebrand.
Brian Hildebrand and Dave Penzer.
Dave Penzer. And just
sang every song.
Yeah, how many can you
backwards, forwards, Spanish, and every language possible known to mankind.
It's still the best channel to listen to. Like, all those songs are so killer.
It is. I love the 70s.
You know, it's funny. I love the 70s. I think that's a VH1 show. You should have been on that.
No, maybe not.
But, you know, we're here in Tampa, and obviously... there was this big function in Tampa that you asked me to be a part of. I couldn't do it because I had to go do Tough Enough, but it was basically to put up the Florida Hall of Fame, Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Well, it's a, not so much a Hall of Fame, just a wall of memorabilia. Mm-hmm. Guys past and present, that wrestled in Fort Esterly Armor here in Tampa.
And it's interesting because back like in the 70s or 60s or even up until the early 80s, there's certain territories that if you grew up in that city, wrestling was like a part of like just the cultural fabric of the city. Like I'm thinking of Calgary. Like people still talk about Stampede Wrestling if they grew up there in the 70s and 80s, or if you were talking about Minneapolis or you're talking about Oregon. And Tampa is very much like that. I mean, everywhere I go, people say, "Oh, I used to watch Dusty Rhodes in the 70s or whatever." Such a big part of the community.
Right. Well, Florida is a great place. We moved here back in 1967. My dad was working out in San Francisco for Roy Shires. So I was 7 years old at the time. Oops, did I just tell my age? Okay. Stop counting with your fingers. But this was a great place for guys to learn their craft. It was easy travel. The longest trip you had on a Wednesday night was to Miami, and you're 5 hours there, 5 hours back. So you were home every night with your family, which is a big luxury, as you know, how the business has changed through the years. Now you got to fly everywhere, but everything was a drive. You know, the schedule was Monday was in Orlando, Tuesday was Tampa, Wednesday was TV taping in the afternoon, and then you drove down to Miami, came back. Thursday night was Jacksonville, and then you had some spot shows here or there during the week, sometimes on the weekends if it's Bayfront or Leesburg or whatever little town there. But it was an easy schedule in comparison to what, you know, we know guys do now.
And who was the promoter?
The original promoter here in Tampa was a good gentleman by the name of Cowboy Luttrell. And then he brought Eddie Graham in here and basically handed over the reins to Eddie Graham.
So during the glory years of, and what was it called, Florida Championship Wrestling. Right. See, I grew up obviously in Winnipeg, so I would maybe see this in an after magazine, as we used to call them. You'd read the ratings in the back, but I don't really know much about Florida Championship Wrestling other than it was a very, you know, storied territory. So how territories would work is, like you mentioned, you'd have your linchpin shows that were every week, and then you'd have the spot shows. So guys would be working in the same town every Monday night, Tuesday night. Right.
Right. TV was on the weekends. I believe it was originally Channel 44, which is no longer in existence here. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Channel 8 after that, if I'm not mistaken. But it was an hour programming. So if you wanted to get more of that entertainment and wrestling value, you had to go pay to go see it, which was a ritual. When Tampa was every Tuesday night. Fort Esterly Army was kind of like... a lot of people here like to call it the Madison Square Garden of the South. Of course, not as big as we know. Maybe not the luxury suites, but I mean, everybody, you know, wrestling fans are creatures of habit. And it was every Tuesday night for 25, almost 30 years. People in that area that could walk to the building. It was sold. It sold out every Tuesday night, no matter rain, sunshine. It didn't matter. People were at the arena, and they were there to see their favorite wrestlers.
And where is Fort Esterly Armory?
It's located in Central Tampa.
Okay. So they're... what kind of kicked off the whole thing is they're tearing down the armory?
Yeah, the Jewish Community Center here of Tampa bought the property. It's a very historic site. The armory housed a lot of famous people through the years. Martin Luther King had two speeches there. John F. Kennedy's speech actually was 4 days prior to him going to Dallas for the death of a...
Really?
Yeah, which is very interesting when you look back at that. He had two or three speeches there. Elvis played there for 3 years. Three times during the years. The Doors played there. If I'm not mistaken, I think Fozzie actually opened up for the Doors. This
was probably the original incarnation.
The original Fozzie. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, there's a lot of famous people and a lot of things happening through the years, pop culture-wise, that it's happened at that Army. But the biggest thing of all was wrestling.
Okay, so
the mainstay there for some 25, 30 years.
So they're kind of tearing it down and then bought by the Jewish Community Center.
Right.
So you guys are now wanting to put up this wall of fame.
Well, my brother and the gentleman who's running the center kind of contacted each other, and there was an idea for three separate walls. One was being as a momentum to guys like John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, The Doors, Elvis, and various people that have played through the years at that that building. And then another wall that was going to be dedicated was one to wrestling itself. And that was kind of memorabilia wall of guys' pictures, guys' names that have gotten an opportunity through the years to work there.
Right.
So my brother's kind of, with this gentleman at the Jewish Community Center, kind of taking this project on. I've kind of chipped in and helped, get some talent. And
So who goes up? Like, I mean, there's been so many guys that came through here. Who names some of the guys that are?
Yeah, there's so many through the years. I mean, Jose Lothario, Dorian Terry Funk, the Briscoes, Jack and Jerry, of course, my dad, Eddie Graham, Rene Goulet, Dick Murdoch, Dusty Rhodes, Dick Slater got his start there, Steve Kern.
Would Hulk Hogan be included in there?
Hogan didn't actually wrestle there, and that's a conversation I've had with him, but he, as a kid, being 17, 18 years old and going to high school here, was a big fan of my dad's. And another gentleman by the name of Ricky Steamboat, who went to high school over in St. Pete.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Steamboat was a Tampa guy.
Yeah, well, Bogusiega High School.
Okay.
When he graduated from, amateur wrestle there. And he, as a young guy, 17, 18 years old, also visited the Army frequently on Tuesdays.
Did you guys used to go there as kids and watch your dad?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Of course, that was a school night when you went on Tuesday and you had to get up early Wednesday. But, I was there religiously. Pretty much.
So what were the rules like? I mean, obviously it was kind of different back then. And when you grew up, I know talking with Bret Hart, like when he grew up, his dad never clued him in, and he used to get in fights at school with other kids because they told him wrestling, maybe wasn't real, or that my dad isn't as tough as he think. How was it for you guys coming to Florida? Because your dad was such a big time heel too.
Yeah, well, it was very interesting back in those days. I mean, those days we're talking about prior to the internet. Any social media out there. It was a very closed-mouth business. It was very mafiose, if I may say, very secretive about what the business was. The heels were really hated. I can't tell you how many times we had our car up on blocks or death threats. We had different names in our
Are slashing your tires.
Yeah. Mailbox, whatever. But, back then as a heel, that's your applause. That means you're doing your job right. And same thing as a babyface. But it was a different environment back then. We stayed close to my dad, and he was very recognizable, back in the day during that time span. Of course, we're talking about a time span where there was no Tampa Bay Rays, there was no Lightning, there was no Buccaneers. The only really form of entertainment in Tampa back then was Championship Wrestling in Florida or the University of Tampa football. That was at the old stadium.
Right.
So it pretty much had the monopoly on the entertainment value here in Tampa.
So, but your dad was the great Boris Malenko. Boris Malenko.
Can't forget that.
So, when you came here, like, who do you remember him working against? And would you sit in the front row or?
There's a balcony level where talent used to go down the set of stairs and then kind of through like a little back garage area, then out into the public. That was always led by a couple local policemen to the ring, being that the riots would incur at different times. Again, my dad had a 15-year feud with Eddie Graham, probably one of the longest feuds I've ever heard of.
15 years?
Yeah, 15 years, on and off. But guys like Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes, when Dusty first started, Rene Goulet, the Missouri Mauler, the list just goes on and on. From a personal thing, of course, my dad was a big influence on me getting in the business, and another gentleman by the name of Carl Gotch. But the one guy that really stuck out, and I've never really said this too much, is a gentleman by the name of Tony Charles, who just recently passed away. He was a big influence on me. He wasn't a big guy in stature, but just his moves and things that he did. He was a European-type wrestler.
Is he an English guy?
Yeah, English guy. Yeah. He wrestled a lot with Billy Robinson back in the day. He was one of those guys, the first guy I really saw that I kind of took a liking to and said, wow, he does some really neat things. I could see myself being like him or emulating him to a certain extent.
Because he had the style that you had, a very technical... you know, you were really literally the man of a thousand holds,
yeah.
right?
And yeah. you were the man of a thousand four holds.
Yeah, I knew about seven.
yeah. yeah. But you knew it a lot of different ways.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, Tony was a big influence on my career. I never got an opportunity to tell him that, and I wish I would have. He just recently passed away in Pensacola. But a big influence as far, again, as the style and the type of the European style that we've seen so many times in the past.
Right, exactly, exactly. So when you came with your dad, like you kind of mentioned it, did you ever get in any kind of fights at school or anything like that because of the dastardly?
No, I think, you know, back then I think more people were scared of me than anything else because who my dad was. You know, my dad did some pretty eccentric promos on TV. They were, and I wouldn't say death threats, but people took everything he said very literally back then. And so, you know, everybody, I remember growing up as a kid and I'd have a friend or something. Hey, you want to come spend the night? No, is your dad going to be home? And that was always the first question. Is your dad going to be home? Like, my dad's going to grab somebody and put him in a Russian sickle or something.
It's, right.
No, he's really a nice guy. He just plays the bad guy on TV.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then kids were scared. Mm-hmm. And I could see that. And back in, you know, we're talking
people
about,
didn't know.
Yeah, we're talking about the mid-70s.
Late right. 70s. You didn't know anything about what was really going on behind the scenes, you know. So who was working on top? It was your dad, obviously, and Eddie Graham. But who else was kind of
Like I said, Jose Lothario was a big name here. A gentleman by the name of Sam Steamboat, Don Curtis. You had your Japanese contingent of Duke Kiyomoka, who was one of the guys that was kind of running the office here a little bit. Hiro Matsuda was a big name. Mm-hmm. Also, Hiro was a big influence on Ron Simmons, Lex Luger, Hogan himself as one of the trainers.
He's the guy who broke Hogan's ankle.
Broke him in and broke his ankle.
Broke him in and broke an ankle.
Broke a lot of things.
And this is, you know, Hogan was on my show and told the story, but for people that didn't hear it, that Hogan went to train, and they saw him as just some, he went to try out, saw him as just some big surfer guy or whatever, and Matsuda, you know, broke his ankle or tore his ligaments or, you know, amputated him or whatever the actual story was. But that's how closed the business was.
Yeah. And they want to see how tough you were. Mm-hmm. Let me damage something to you and see if you'll come back.
Right.
Come back, that means you got some heart.
What about Dusty Rhodes? When did he come into the area?
He was more towards the mid part of the 70s. I'm not sure. I'm not real good with dates.
Yeah.
But he came in with Dick Murdoch when they first formed the tag team and then kind of really took a singles career and kind of blossomed here in Tampa. I mean,
Were you still watching?
All the time.
What'd you think of a guy like Dusty?
Very flamboyant, had a lot of charisma. Mm-hmm. He was very different for that era. Back then, it was a lot of just hard-nosed wrestlers, a lot of, you know, Germans and Russians and, you know, all these people playing different country characters. But he was definitely totally different from what was going on in that era.
Mm-hmm. So when you started thinking about training, did you train in Florida?
Yeah, I trained in Florida.
With your dad?
With my dad.
He was your teacher?
Pretty much. And a lot of things, you know, self-taught, just watching. I was one of those real studious guys when it came to watching film and just watching old matches and kung fu theater, of all things, believe it or not. I used to watch that on Saturdays and see what I could pick up.
You see if you can pick up some moves?
Yeah, I don't know. Big Bruce Lee fan.
Yeah. So when did you start finding out that maybe, I mean, when you grew up, did you think wrestling was completely 100% a real thing?
To a certain extent, the first time I saw my dad bleed, which he did on several occasions because he was one of the first guys ever to do the Russian chain match. If I'm not mistaken, he probably invented it because he had one every night and he bled every single night.
Mm.
The first time I was a kid, I believe I was six, seven years old, and I think it was Omaha, Nebraska. I know it was somewhere in Nebraska. And back then, he would keep us at a hotel. Not that he didn't want anybody to know who his family was, but just from a safety standpoint, we were on the road back then. You were like a band of gypsies. So we would stay at the hotel. He would go work, come back, pick us up, move on to the next town. Hmm. So I think it was one night we didn't go to the hotel. I'm not really sure of the story, but I sat there and I watched my dad bleed, and I thought it was real. So it was really, really hard back then. I was 26. No, I'm just teasing. No, I was young, and the first time, you know, you see your dad bleeding, and without knowing what the business was about, it kind of affected me.
Did he try and, because I know, like, when my kids, especially when they were a few years younger, sitting in the front row at WrestleMania and just crying, like, if I was losing or getting beat or whatever, just no matter what I said, I couldn't convince them that it's okay, you know, we're playing, it's a show. They didn't want to hear it. They believed 100%. Did your dad ever try that, or it was just like, hey, kid, this is the way it goes?
Pretty much. I mean, half the fun is just, you know, just kind of finding out for yourself.
Yeah.
You know.
How did you find out?
And then there's still some times I don't know if I found out yet. I'm not sure the exact moment or the time, just, you know, I think just watching things on my own, just kind of figuring it out.
So was it kind of like, did you ever go up to him when you were 18, 19, ready to train? And like, you know, Dad, I know there's no Santa Claus. Like, let's see. Yeah. I get it now. Or did you just never really talked about?
Kind of never really talked about it. Just, you know, I kind of figured it out on my own. And even, you know, even like all the years that I worked in Japan, and part of the Japan training was really not letting a lot of the guys know up front.
Yeah.
I saw some of the earlier matches. Those guys really went at it.
And
it
right.
Kind of created a, you know, different outlook on the business and gave them a little bit of a harder nose edge to
yeah.
business. And that was always the mentality of the training and the way they had things laid out in Japan. You know, you didn't tell the first two matches. You just went out and...
Well, that's right, yeah.
That's the way it was.
Yeah, the guys that were actually working didn't really know. They might be told to finish, but the rest was just
right.
Go out there and see what happens.
And you had to reach a certain plateau in your career for you to be told that it kind of wasn't on the up and up at that point.
Right. You know? Did Eddie Graham bring in a lot of Japanese guys at all to Florida? Was it that type of a territory?
Not really. I mean, there's some periodically. One of the, and you'll know this gentleman, Tiger Tori, Masala Tori, who refereed for, and still refereeing for New Japan
mm-hmm.
Wrestling, is my amateur wrestling coach when I was, and also my babysitter at one point.
Really?
Yeah, he was living down here in Tampa and kind of helping out the Japanese guys when they came in town, like Masa Saito, Riki Choshu, and there's a couple more. But he actually babysitted me sometimes, and Hiro Matsuda had an amateur wrestling school, and Hattori actually was one of the coaches at that time. He was third in the world back, I can't remember the date, but
mm-hmm.
he was a really good amateur wrestler. So he was my wrestling coach, and then it was funny, 30-some-odd years later, I'm wrestling professionally in the New Japan Pro Wrestling office, and he's the referee.
You know, kind of like your boss in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
your liaison. Yeah.
We're still good friends to this day. He's a very dear friend of mine.
Yeah, he's a great, great guy.
Yep.
How important was it for, like, in your dad's mind for you to learn amateur wrestling? Was that kind of a prerequisite back in those days?
Not really. It's just that was always taught that was the foundation of our business. It's like building a house. You got to lay the floor down before you put the walls and the roof on, type of deal. And that was really my background. You know, I'm unlike a lot of guys that got in the business who ate, drank, and slept the business and always fantasized about being in it. That really wasn't my first being in the business. I had an amateur career. I had a car accident back in 1976, told I'd never wrestle again. And I got guys like Tony Charles and just watching the moves, and I was drinking, okay, how could I still continue to wrestle and still do the wrestling moves and all that in a professional state? And then I started learning how to wrestle, and then I just took off from there. And then I had the luxury of meeting Carl Gotch, who was training a lot of the Japanese guys and got me my first gig in UWF.
Now let's talk, first of all, about, you mentioned your car accident. I remember first meeting you had the zipper scar in the back of your neck. You still have it. Didn't go anywhere.
No.
Didn't wash
it's
away.
It's like my suit. I just unzip it.
But you're talking about neck surgeries. I mean, it happens on, you know, not a daily basis, but happens frequently now.
Mm-hmm.
Guys get the, you know, the orthoscopic little Dr. Steve or Dr. Joe surgery,
right,
and they're gone for 3 or 4 months. But your surgery, I'm imagining, if it was in the 70s, is probably a lot more archaic than that.
Yeah, well, medicine's changed a lot in 30
sure.
years. Now they go through the front, and, like, you know, John Cena is a prime example. He had a surgery, and 2 seconds later, he's out working.
Literally showed up the same day, yeah.
Pittsburgh.
Right, yeah, with a little Band-Aid on his neck after getting this invasive, whatever the proper word is.
I had a fusion done, a C3 and C4, and had one of those halos where the screws are screwed into your head for 6 months when you're 16 years old during the summer. It's not fun.
And that's heavy, too. I mean, that's literally screwed into your head.
Yeah, literally,
like Frankenstein.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So because you had your whole career ahead of you, and you obviously worked some tremendous matches for many, many years, doing some pretty high impact stuff, and your neck never bothered you?
Never bothered me. I always did bridges, always worked my neck, so I had, you know, that insulation of neck muscles around me. The only really one time I ever had a really bad stinger was wrestling Terry Gordy, and you know, during the heat. During the summer days in Japan, it can be very hot in some of the buildings. They're either really cold or just really hot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was one of those summer days, and it was really hot. I went to a German suplex, and my knee kind of buckled. He slipped out of me, and I came crashing down the top of my head. That's probably the one night that I really felt a little stinger and felt that electricity feeling going down. But never stopped me from keep working, though, because I didn't, you know, something I still enjoyed doing.
Well, the fact that you were working Terry Gordy, too, is probably like almost twice your size for a shoot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big dude to be German suplexing, too, even just coming down on that. Yeah, that's funny about Japan. In the summer, super, super hot, and in the winter, super cold.
And then you throw the TV lights on top of the 100-degree weather outside. Now you're wrestling in a sauna.
It's probably not like that as much now. I mean, I would hope not. No. I don't work there anymore, but you'd go there in the summertime to some of those buildings, like some of the outside ranch towns, let's say, and it would be so freaking hot. It'd be brutal, like impossible.
I don't think they believed in air conditioning back then.
Yeah.
Or now for that matter.
Didn't have it. Yeah. Maybe now they have like the bigger arenas or whatever. But
they had those fans.
Yeah. They would sell like actual fans, like Chinese fans that you wave as merch.
Yeah.
In the merch stand.
Yeah. And it kept everybody cool.
Yeah. They'd sell.
I'm still trying to figure out how my brother could hold it while we were working a tag match.
So you mentioned Carl Gotch. Now, he's kind of a real legendary figure. I never met him, but the name Gotch itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is synonymous in wrestling with the name Gracie in MMA.
Right.
Gotch means tough shooter, stretch you, beat you up. I mean, what kind of a guy was Carl Gotch?
He was not real approachable. He was very stern. He was from the old school, very old European style type guy. Probably grew up poor and probably had to fight his way to where he got. And you could see that in his eyes and the way he talked to you. But he was probably one of the most extremely knowledgeable guys when it came to catch-cad wrestling or shoot-style wrestling, however you want to call it, or just the magnitude of holds and moves and counter-holds. And, he was the first guy really to go, from an American standpoint, besides guys like Dick Byers, who was the Destroyer, to really go to Japan and make a name for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And trained a lot of guys. You know, one of the guys that trained Inoki and Fujinami and Fujiwara and Kido and
In Japan, he trained them?
In Japan and also here, he was living out in Odessa area. He had a house there on the lake.
No kidding.
Yeah, for many years. Maeda, Takada, I mean, the list goes on and on. He was, and still to this day, referred to as a god of Japan from a wrestling standpoint.
So companies would send their guys to Gotch?
Yeah.
As kind of going to see like Obi-Wan Kenobi or something, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Almost like you didn't have to go there to the dojo. You had to come here to the dojo.
And this is where you would learn how to be a man.
Pretty much.
How did you end up hooking up with him to train?
He was living next to us when we were living in California. He got to be really good friends with my dad. And then he moved to Tampa about the same time we moved. Was kind of an next-door neighbor.
Hmm.
And my dad had a gym at the time at the height of his popularity where he opened up a gym. Like everybody else does, it makes a little money in the wrestling business. I'll go open up a gym. And, of course, Maliga's Health Club was an apartment complex. And we had a mat that we used to roll out on the weekends, move all the equipment. Carl would teach. And it was me, my brother, and a couple other local guys. Actually, Iron Sheik, when he first came to this country, Vaziri, was about 180 pounds soaking wet.
To train?
Ripped to shreds.
Wow.
Was living down in Tampa and kind of working out with us. He was incredible at the time. Changed a little bit since.
Yeah, but he was a great amateur
great
Olympic wrestler, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so when you went to train with Gotch, it was pro wrestling, but with a real heavy amateur slant to
it. There was a lot of guys in his era that were very scared to work with him just because of his reputation and just the type of guy that he was. My dad never had that problem, probably why they're better friends than most of his comrades with him, but my dad always respected him and thought very highly of him, as Carl did my dad. But there was a lot of guys that were very scared to work with him.
But your dad was a real, I hate to use the word shooter because I don't really know if he was an actual shooter for real, but he had a very shoot style, amateur style, right?
Not so much. I mean, dad was more of an entertainer.
Okay.
He learned, from what he told me a lot that he learned was from the Dusicks out in the Midwest area.
The Dusicks?
Dusicks. It was like Joey, Mel, I can't remember all the guys. It was like the Marx Brothers. It was like Harpo, Groucho.
Right.
There's a whole bunch of them. They're everywhere. It's kind of like the Gueros.
Yeah.
But, that's where he told me, through talks through the years that he really learned his craft.
It's from there?
Yeah. And other places, of course.
So when you first went to train, was there a lot of drills that you had to do? As far as, like, would he stretch you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that's back then kind of what we're talking about
with Hogan.
With Hogan. I mean, that was the protocol back then. You know, let me rip your mouth up and let me make you bleed and let you tap. And I'm still not going to let go after you tapped. And see what kind of heart you had. See how long you could last. You know, see if you came back was more important.
And you knew this going in? Did your dad give you the tip on it?
Not so much a tip. I could just see it.
Mm-hmm.
You can just see it when you're watching guys. This isn't going to be as easy as I thought it was. It's not a walk in the park for sure.
So you must have been a pretty tough guy to go in there and like, okay.
Either that or really stupid. I'm still debating that some 30 years later.
But, you know, we even had that too, training up in Calgary. I mean, Stu wasn't there, but I've said this many times in this show, it was the Stu style of training. So before we even got in the ring, it might have been 10 to 14 days because our training was 3 months where, we had to do 500 hack squats a day, run a mile backwards, wheelbarrow drills, sit on the back and in the mat on your back, and they would drop a medicine ball on your stomach, but you have to have your eyes closed so you wouldn't know who was getting it. Like, they really were pounding out the guys and really wearing you down to see, I think, if you're mentally tough enough to do this.
Yeah. And I think it's also a weeding out process.
Right.
You know, who's got it, who doesn't, who really wants this, and how bad do they want it, and that really kind of tells a lot.
Who was in the class when you were training?
Really didn't have any class. I really didn't have any class.
No, I know
that. Didn't have no class.
For sure.
We really didn't have my dad was just forming the school. My dad stopped wrestling probably somewhere about 76, 77 was his last run. I think it was up in Knoxville, Tennessee. And then he decided to open up a wrestling school, which opened up, I believe, in 78, because we had it running for about 15 to 18 years until September of 94 when my dad passed. But we had a wrestling school at that time, one in Tampa, one down in Miami, and we have a great list of guys that have come through the
name some process. Of them.
Tugboat, Fred Ottman, Al Perez, Barry Horowitz, some Mark Merrow. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say Van Hammer, even though Steve Regal, if he hears this, so he loves it. He loves to tell me that was probably one of the worst classes I've ever had. Yeah. The graduating class of 1980, whatever it was.
It was all your fault.
Yeah, it was all my fault, but I'm still in charge of that.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Waubman. 1, 2, 3, X-Bug.
Biggest name, probably. You know.
Kane.
Oh, really? Yeah. There you go. There's your biggest name.
Well, it's not that big. It's only four letters.
Yeah.
But, we had a lot of guys through the years.
Smiley.
Norman Smiley. Yeah, mm-hmm. Norman Smiley.
Shamrock.
Ken didn't come through the process, but I was working with Ken when he was working up in the Carolinas.
Okay.
And his wife at the time was working for U.S. Air, so we would fly down. Kind of helped him get started with the whole working in Pancras with the shoot company there. And then from there, he just Lawson Dowden made a.
And that was actually a real name of a company, by the way, Pancras.
Pancras.
I think it was like actually Pancras or something like that.
I don't know what it was.
But I had no idea what that means. One of those weird Japanese, English.
Crazy.
Maybe it's Greek or something.
So, well, it's like, you work for them. War.
Yeah, war.
Wrestling and romance.
Wrestling and romance, yeah.
Like, who comes up with these names?
I was more on the romance side.
Yeah,
than the wrestling
not
side,
so much a wrestling.
Yeah. You'd go for Japan for like the Super Fire Battle Angel Winter Tour.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, what?
Me and my friend Dolphine. On purpose.
Super Delphine,
yeah.
You told Super Delphine, which is actually Super Dolphin, that he was off the car. They left you off on porpoise.
Stupid humor that still works.
Yeah, exactly. So when you were a kid, something that you mentioned earlier about going to Omaha, would you go from territory to territory and have to move like every year?
Yeah. Well, my dad says that I was conceived or made in Missouri. I was born in New Jersey, and I was raised in Tampa. So I got around, and I didn't even do anything yet.
Not bad for 2 years.
Yeah, but I remember living in California. We lived in Texas for a lot while. Lived in Dallas. My dad was working in Houston for Paul Bosch at the time, going back and forth. The Carolinas. I went to first grade in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm.
Had a southern accent, which is really funny. Only when I read. What else did we move? Florida, of course. We moved here in 67 because back then it was a great place to raise kids. We were living on the beach. We had like a little commune there with Harold Matsuda and his family right on Clearwater Beach. And back then it was just, it was a great place to raise kids. Like I said earlier that, my dad was home every night. So, it wasn't like it is now where sometimes dad leaves, you don't see him for 4 or 5 days, if not longer than that.
Right.
So, he got to interact with his children every day.
So once you came here, he kind of settled down and stayed?
Yeah. Yeah, gotcha. I've been here since 1967 and never left.
So it's almost a little bit like being like an army brat.
Pretty much.
Pretty
much. I remember going, I can't remember what year it was, but I was in like 2 or 3 different schools, which makes it hard as you get older because you start bonding with other people and you start accumulating friendships, and then you have to get up and leave, and it's like, oh, well, hold on a second. Can't my friend come,
Well, yeah, and then it's probably harder for him too because now he's not just picking the family. He's got to disrupt you guys' lives.
Yeah, you go through those things as a kid. You start looking back like – start regretting what your dad's doing, but then as you get older, you realize he did all that for one reason. That was to give you, everything he had from
to
a school standpoint,
yeah.
To support you, and that was his way of making a living.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it took a while for me to realize that. I'm just seeing dad packing his bag and leaving, thinking, him and my mom fight her.
Yeah.
Every week.
As soon as you see that bag by the door, you start feeling that tug, you know?
We've all been there.
Yeah, exactly. We all still go through it. You know, we're on the road, leaving home and leaving your kids. And it's not, it's like you said, it's what we do, but it doesn't make it any easier.
No, not at all.
You know? And I think were you hanging out with other wrestlers' kids? You mentioned this with Hiro Matsuda's family. Did the wrestlers kind of hang together?
Not really. My dad would have the guys come over, you know, once in a while. Funny story is Lord Littlebrook was one of the original, like, really first midget guys that really got over, and then later on kind of took over the book, so to speak. He was in charge of all the little guys.
Oh, he was like the head of the little...
The head honcho.
Okay.
Yeah, living out in, I think it was Missouri or Kansas City. Well, when you're a kid, you have no concept of looking at somebody eye to eye like that and thinking, well, he looks older than me, but I wonder if he still wants to play. And I used to ask my dad why he won't play with me. And then my dad, sounds funny. Because
he's 40 years old.
He's back then he was like 20 or 30 years old. Yeah. And his wife was really tall. But it's funny, but you know, things like that you grow up with, you know, I met Haystacks Kahuna as a kid. First time I ever met him, I started to cry because I thought he was going to like eat me or something. And back then he was a big guy. It was like meeting Big Show.
Right.
And, you know, then next day you're meeting a guy with half a mouth of teeth. Then you're meeting a midget the next day. I mean, it's like the circus just opened the door and you're just walking in through all these fun houses.
That's what I had Brad on the show, and he said the same. It was like growing up in a circus menagerie.
Oh, yeah.
There'd be like a midget, and then there's like a bear, like a wrestling bear living under my, you know, living under my house. Yeah.
Well, it's like the old joke, and there's a midget, and there's a bear, and they all walk into a bar.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a bar run by Ed Graham.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. When you started, what was the first place that you worked? Did you start in Florida Championship Wrestling too?
No, I was... just working local things here around a couple island shows, whenever they, you know, independent stuff locally. And then my big dream was to go to Japan because I knew that was the kind of style I wanted to do.
Because you had trained with Gotch?
Because I trained with Gotch and because I watched tapes of it and always seemed like that would be the most comfortable place for me and a great place to start. And it ended up being.
Yeah, well, because it's more of a technical style.
Yeah.
You know, and not as much of a... Because even back in those days, there was a lot, like you said, a lot of show business involved. Mm-hmm. You're talking about Dusty, or you said, you know, Boris Malenko, or it was starting to get more into that zone.
Yeah, what happened was a lot of the guys like Tiger Mask, who went off on his own and kind of exposed the business and took his mask off, put it back on, and called himself Super Tiger. And then there was a guy by the name of Maeda, Takada, Yamazaki, which were all really big names, but kind of like rebels for other companies, all formed this one company called UWF. And Carl was kind of booking for them because his son-in-law was referee. And so that was my first tour ever was 1983 or 84, somewhere in there. My first tour was an international tour, no pun intended, but I had Raul Mata, who lives here locally in Tampa, who's Mexican. Marty Jones, English Johnny guy. South, and a guy by the name of Millie Zerno. And there was five of us. And so that was my first, I think I was 19, 20 years old. My first.
The other foreigners on the tour?
All foreigners on the tour. Still friends with Marty this day whenever I'm in England, he comes by.
Well, and Johnny South was pretty crazy too.
Oh yeah.
I'm mixing up Johnny Saint with Johnny South. Yeah, but I was in Hamburg with Johnny South in 93 and he had a big crease in his head. And I said to him, he used to just sit at the bar just drinking. I said, what happened? Where did that crease come in your head? We were talking. He's like, I got hit with an axe. I was like, what? It was just somebody hit me with an axe.
Tackle, drop down, axe.
Axe handle.
Axe handle.
So, I mean, how was that, like, kind of going over to
that was interesting. I was young, and that was the first time I really kind of left home from that distance. And being there with a bunch of guys that are totally different from me. But, you know, in this business, the one common denominator is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the fun too, is meshing with guys that are from Europe or from Mexico or from Canada even.
Yeah.
And you know, that's always been the fun part for me, getting an opportunity to work with these guys, be around them, and you get a little education in itself while you're on the road with these guys.
Well, and it's also like an international language. You get in there, you lock up and then just go.
Oh, of course.
Cause you're not calling spots in the back in those days.
That company, when it started, was kind of a shoot company. It was kind of 50-50. You kind of knew what the outcome was, but it was a little work closer. Five matches a night and they lasted about 40, sometimes 30 to 40 minutes a match, which is way too long, which they realized one of the downfalls of the company was the matches were too long for not using any of the ropes or not giving any of the high flying or the entertaining part.
Got it.
So a lot of mat work for 40 minutes can be very, very
well. That's
very...
also kind of that old style. Like if you watch, they always talk about, you know, a Dory Funk Jack Briscoe match, and you watch it now, and I mean, it's a lot of mat work and a lot of holds and a lot of not a lot going on.
No,
you know, I mean, there's an art form to it, but if you watch it as just an uneducated fan, you might even use the word boring.
Right.
But that's just kind of how the style was.
Of course. Well, that's. I mean, I remember one time me and my brother were in Sapporo, and there's a little museum there called Ring Palace where they have all the magazines, like a merchandise place. And the guy, knowing that we were kind of students a little bit of Carl, brought us in, sat us down on the couch, and put a tape in of, I think it was Carl and Inoki against Sakaguchi and Luthez, whatever. There's some combination of four of those guys. And about 5 minutes in, me and my brother looking at each other like, do you want to go? Because it's really boring. But, you know, four legends in our business. But it was just – that was just the way the company was and the business was. You know, back in the day, an arm drag was a finish or a headlock takedown was like, you know, doing a super DDT off the top rope.
Yeah, or a drop kick would be like doing like a double moonsalt. Like, exactly, oh, what a high flyer. Exactly. Antonio Roca.
Yeah, so for that time in that era, that stuff was great. It's just that we've taken and gone so far past that. When you look at it now for us, it's like, wow, that's really boring.
Mm-hmm.
But not then.
So when you talk about going to UWF as one of your, UWF, right? Of your first companies, you basically worked more in Japan than you ever did in the States until, you know, ECW years, right? Like you didn't work a lot in the States before Japan, did you?
No, I worked UWF maybe a year and a half before they folded. 2 years, if that. And then I worked for All Japan for 6 years, New Japan for 5 or 6. So I was there for probably about 14 years.
Pretty much exclusively, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the fun part for me was when I finally came over here to the States, I mean, people were like, hey, look at this new guy. Well, new guy's already been around for 14 years.
That's right. Overnight sensation.
You haven't heard of me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But a lot of that was my choice. I've gotten people who've, you know, inquired about my services through the years. But I just like Japan wrestling. I always looked at it as like a freelancing painter. You know, no one had to tell me, you know, you have these canvas, these brushes, these paint, and just go out and do my thing. And to me, that was fun.
And not have to worry about time limits or anything like that.
Look at that camera. Look at this camera.
Yeah.
It was just go out there and do what you enjoy doing and you know.
When you were growing up in junior high school or whatever here, did you always know you wanted to get into the business?
Not really. I think it's probably towards maybe after I got in the accident, I started thinking at 16 years old when you get a car wreck like that and then your doctor tells you you're not going to play sports anymore. Because prior to that, I wrestled amateur AAU Junior Olympic tournaments. I played Little League football for 6 years. So I was very, very active, as most kids are. And then at 16 years old, it's a very influential time in your life for a doctor to tell you you'll probably never play sports or wrestle again in your life. And that was really hard for me to kind of digest at that age. But I wanted to prove them wrong. Again, I think sometimes when doctors make an assessment of somebody, they just look at the layman that sits on the couch and watches TV, not the athlete that does this and he's prepared for it. And so, you know, some 30 some odd years later, I was still doing it.
Did you ever talk about it with your brothers? Jody, older than you or younger than you?
Older.
So did you go in the business first or did he?
He was.
Okay.
He actually was trained more by Carl than I was. He was with Carl pretty much every single day for like 2 years.
Because you had more of a when I say junior heavyweight, the only reason I say that is because you had more of a high flying side to your work, which Joe didn't have as much.
No, he was a lot more technical than I was.
Right. And I think that's why you were able to kind of transform and go from place to place because you had that style as well, maybe.
Yeah, a little bit. A little more well rounded. I
guess. Who was it that put you together as a team?
All Japan was more tag team based. You know, when you look back and you look over, there's not a whole lot of single guys that went over there. Even when Hanson was a single guy, he was still even a team with Spivey or Johnny Ace or any one of those.
Brody.
Or Ted DiBiase. So everything's tag team. It was me and my brother. It was Doug Furness and our friend Danny Crawford. You had Steve Williams and Gordy. You had, forget the names.
Billy Black and Joel Deaton.
Deaton.
Yeah.
You had a lot of different tag teams.
Bulldogs.
With the Bulldogs, yeah, of course.
The classic match of the Malenkos versus the Bulldogs.
Yeah, Tiger Jet Singh and Abdullah the Butcher. What a great tag team that was. Holy mackerel.
Did you guys have to work with them?
No, thank God.
I was going to say, what do you do with them?
No, exactly. Well, one of the funny stories that Phil LaFont, a.k.a. Danny Crawford, loves to tell is that we used to always open our mouths saying, you know, they never put us with Hanson or Spivey. And, of course, this they never say never in the wrestling business. And we show up at a building one time in some town in Japan, and we look on the the maid card that's always on the door in the dressing room, and we're looking, can't find our names. We look on top, it says Malenko Brothers versus Hanson and Spivey.
Wow.
And of course, we looked around going, see, we opened our mouth.
Because those guys were, I mean, while Spivey legit was 6'7", 6'8".
Yeah, he was very tall.
And Hanson is, you know, a bull in a china shop.
Yeah, I'll take his glasses off. He's pretty much legally blind.
You can't see anything, right?
No, I just said, just don't hit the guy in the middle when you're looking at me.
Johnny Smith said that he finally figured out that whenever Hanson threw a clothesline, he would just jump in the air because he knew it would hit him in the chest. Yeah. If he did, it would hit him in the face every time.
Exactly. If you kind of help yourself and start to fall back before you get drilled, it kind of takes away the pain a little bit.
How was it working for Giant Baba? Obviously, legendary, legendary performer. Did you have a lot of relationship with him?
He was kind of like that silent boss. Everything was kind of really dumb. The wife kind of wore the pants in the family, and she was more dealings than anybody else. I think I had maybe 3 conversations in the 6 years that I worked.
Really?
Yeah. And they were one time just smoke blown in my face from a cigar. And then one time me and my brother went to Hawaii and trained Kikuchi and Kobashi, who ended up being a huge star in Japan.
Kobashi, one of the greatest of all time.
So we went there for 2 weeks to work with those guys. And Baba was in his penthouse on the beach. We saw him like one day. He had a convertible just to accommodate his head coming out of the car and gave us some spending money for the week. And that was, probably one of the only really conversations that we had with the guy.
But you knew, obviously, he respected you and appreciated your
work.
He brought you over.
Yeah, well, we were getting ready to go on a tour, and he called, and through Lord Bleers is a gentleman who lives in Hawaii that worked for the company for many years and kind of like a liaison between some of the talent. Called and said, Baba would like for you to work out with, go to Hawaii, we'll pay you for 2 weeks. And, of course, I had to think about it, and that took about a second. Young, I want to go to the beach to work out with, I forget his real Japanese name, but it was Kikuchi and Kenta Kobashi.
So when these were kind of younger boys?
Yeah, they were like 18, 19 years old.
So what was your job to train Kobashi?
Work out with him, you know, and then we worked out with him for like maybe 3 or 4 days, and then Baba said, take off, just enjoy the beach on me and have fun before you go to, because we were leaving right from Hawaii right to Japan, so it was a nice little downtime before we're busting our butts for.
Did you know Kobashi was going to be as good as he was? Because he's probably if not the greatest Japanese performer, top 2 or 3 for sure of all
time. He was really good at a really young age, you know. But the one thing I did see and what happens to a lot of the guys there is just the wear and tear of their bodies.
Well, yeah.
Just, you know, he became 40 years old and he could barely do anything.
We're just beating the shit out of each other, dropping each other in the heads.
And... Yeah, because there's no like hiatus. I mean, it's not like here where guys, you know, it's a little less over there. It's 100% all the time and. You know, it was just nonstop. It's a very physical type of work over there.
Well, to the point that when did you work at all with Misawa?
A little bit.
I mean, what I heard is when he passed away in the ring, that basically he was decapitated with his head still on, like his neck basically just broke from all the wear and tear, and it was just one bump too many. Yeah. I mean, that's indicative of the work rate between those guys.
Oh, of course, yeah, just the Japanese guys,
right?
Sure.
No, you guys wouldn't exactly go do that.
And the mentality of Japanese culture is, you know, you don't say no.
Mm-hmm.
Failure is a big deal.
Don't show injury.
Exactly.
You know?
So you kind of bite your lip and you keep working. And sometimes you have to pay the price. A lot of guys have.
When you, the classic match that we talked about that I watched on tape before I even met you, because I'd always heard so much about Malenkos and Bulldogs. I mean, was that only a one-time thing?
No, we wrestled them a couple times before, and after that.
How'd you like working? I mean, that was always my favorite team when I was a kid. I just loved the British Bulldogs.
They're fun. They're both great guys. You know, Dynamite's a legend. He's a legend. He's probably the reason why a lot of us, myself, you, and, you know, I mean, the list goes on to guys even entering the business now at our height, weight, and kind of style that we do were the reason why we got in the business. I learned a lot from him for the small amount of time that I was with him over there. But he was... You know, he was towards the end of his career. His hips were really bad at that point, but he was still going, still chucking along. And, you know, Davey was Davey, strong as an ox. And he was just, both guys were very fun to work with and very giving.
The thing about Davey, too, is he was as strong as an ox and a big guy, but he started as a little guy. So he could move and I don't know if, not high fly, but he could have that type of match when he was motivated, when he wanted to.
Yeah. There's a move, and, you know, it's a short arm scissor, and I saw him, I don't think I've ever seen anybody do this, but it was Shinji Takano, which was probably, he's about 6'2", 6'3", probably 260, and, you know, weight distribution of a human is a lot different than weight on a barbell, and he leaned over in a short arm scissor and picked this guy up straight up, like with no effort, and that was pretty incredible.
Yeah, because you're basically just pulling from your lower back and basically one side of your body. Yeah. That's what short arm, and legs too.
Yeah, I mean, I'd always do that with him, but I was a lot easier than picking up a guy at 6'2", which now the weight gets distributed all the way to a guy's head.
So yeah.
Again, it's a lot different than a barbell weight.
How did you end up going from All Japan to New Japan?
My brother was kind of at that point getting out of the business, and so I was now became a single performer, and New Japan was what made it opposite from All Japan. Is New Japan was more about single guys.
And so, bigger guys, too, right?
Bigger guys, and they had more did more things with the cruiserweight division or junior heavyweight, light heavyweight, however you want to call it. Because you had Liger as their mainstay. Then you had the guys underneath that. They did stuff. I mean, everybody even that went up to the rankings, guys like Hasei and all these other guys were junior heavyweights at one time until they moved up the rankings.
But then you had this, like, classic group of foreign guys.
Yeah.
All you guys came in at once, it seemed. Like, I'm sure it wasn't that quickly, but as a faraway fan watching, one day I get a tape and there's Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit, Wild Pegasus, Black Tiger, Eddie Guerrero, and then you know Scorpio's there, and you got Pillman shows up there, and you got like all of these
guys. Right. That's Wonder Kid.
Shut up, Dean.
Yeah,
I know you are, but what am I?
Yeah.
But I mean, how was that for you? Because you're talking about being in All Japan, where it's very much based around the tag teams, and you're working with big guys and some of the guys that are kind of in your level, but as far as your work style, but you're talking about British Bulldogs and working with Hanson and Spivey and Gordy, and then you go to this world where there's a bunch of guys that all work similar style to what you can do. That must have been like a whole new world.
Yeah, I just went to Disney World, basically, from a kid's perspective.
Right.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome working with Chris and Eddie every night and work with all these guys. And, you know, Liger was always fun to work with. And
Otani.
Yeah, Otani was a young and upcoming guy. Can't remember half the guys' names, but yeah, it was Kanemoto. I mean, they had just a list and a great roster of a bunch of guys that could really go. So every night was a challenge and it was fun.
Did you have any relationship with the Guerrero family? It was, you know, you're talking about Florida. I guess Gory was probably a little bit older than Boris was. Did they ever work together?
They worked in the Carolinas.
Actually, really?
Me and Eddie first started talking, you know, and he mentioned that his dad mentioned my dad one time in a conversation many, many years ago. They were actually cross paths up in the Carolinas when Eddie's dad and my dad were working. So I thought that was pretty neat.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have that in common being the second generation with Eddie and with a lot of guys.
It was something to the fact that they were talking about Eddie's dad, I guess, was having some issues being Mexican, working in the Carolinas. My dad said something to the effect of, you know, you wear a sombrero, I wear a yarmulke. Kind of like in the same boat type of deal. You know, not that my dad ever played a Jewish character.
Right.
Actually, the ironic thing is my dad played a German character being a Jew.
Wow, you're right. Prep, yeah.
But only in the wrestling business, right?
How did he come up with the name Malenko?
When you look back at that, and I've never actually asked Vince this, Vince McMahon, but supposedly from what I've heard is Vince's dad actually came up with the name Malenko.
For Boris?
Yeah.
Boris worked for Vince's, Sr.
Yes.
In New York?
Yeah, up in New York.
So did he ever do like a garden shows?
Oh, yeah. My dad worked. My dad started the same night as Joe Scarpa, which was Chief J. Strongbow.
Right.
Who ended up working down here and at Fort Heslin Armory as Joe Scarpa for many years down here.
Really?
And
yeah, the Italian Indian.
Yeah. My dad said he was part of the Wapaho tribe.
Wapaho tribe.
You see where I get my sense of humor.
Yeah.
My dad worked a lot with Bruno Sammartino when Bruno first broke in the business and a lot of guys.
How high up on the card did he make it? Did he ever do any main events?
Not really. Okay. Just kind of like he won as Larry Simon, how original. You know, took his name. Then it was like Larry Duggan. Then it became Christian Duggan. I mean, you know, the process of the business trying to find yourself until it came to the Florida territory. Then it became the Great Malenko.
But Senior gave him the name of Malenko as German heel.
Pretty much.
Wow.
Well, Malenko was Russian.
Okay, Russian.
He had the name of Otto von Krupp, which is another classic name. Yeah, it's amazing how many names you occur. Well, hell, look at me, Stinko Malenko.
Dino Machino. Did you ever have any other name besides Dean Malenko?
That's probably one of the best Dean Malenko, a.k.a. Dean Malenko stories, was I was Dino Sanchez. it's funny, wherever territory, whatever city you went in, then my dad would have shows for his students. You know, if it was a prominent Hispanic crowd, we had more Spanish people on the card. And we had that night, it was pretty weak. So I could have passed for some kind of Hispanic character, I guess, being dark hair. dark complected at the time. So my dad called me Dino Sanchez. So as I was going to the ring, all these people are speaking Spanish, and I'm just like high-fiving them going, see. They could probably say derogatory things about me, and I'm just agreeing with them saying see. But, yeah, I was Dino Sanchez for one night.
One night only.
Probably not as good as my dad, who, Albuquerque, New Mexico, got to the building, and his name wasn't on the card, and they said, where's my name? And they pointed to it, and they named him Yussel the Muscle. No lie.
What is that?
Yeah, Yussel the Muscle. That was his name for the night in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Yussel the Muscle.
Yeah.
The first night I ever went and worked for in Japan ever was for Onita FMW. And Lance and I went over as a team, and he was really upset. He goes, we're not even on the show. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's the first night of the show. And I looked through the card, and I found our names. The reason why I couldn't find it is it said Kleiss and Runtz.
Sound like two German guys. Kleiss and Runtz.
Kleiss and Runtz. We were in the main event against Onita. I was like, that's us. That's Chris and Lance. Yeah. Kleiss and Runtz.
Well, you know how they tear your name up there anyway.
How?
You know, well, it's one goes from Malenko to Marinko.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you talk about working. What were the differences between working in All Japan, New Japan as a company?
Not that much difference. I mean, I think I felt a little more comfortable in New Japan only because Hattori was there at the time. He was taking care of me.
And you knew him.
And Fujinami is a very close friend of our families. So I felt a little more secure, I guess, in my job, knowing these guys that were working in the office there.
Mm-hmm.
And probably just suited-wise better for me overall, but I had a great experience working in All Japan, made some great friends there, and had a really good time for the 5-6 years that I was there.
Because you're one of the few guys, well, not a few, but there's probably more than a handful, but you had a strong run with both companies, you know?
Yeah, I was at the latter part when I remember Doc Steve Williams was working for New Japan when he worked in 1 week, worked for both companies because he finished out over there and then his contract got bought out by Baba's company.
Mm.
Back then, there was a working relationship between both companies.
Really?
So when Sakaguchi or who's ever headed at that time was Inoki would talk to Baba. So you had to have permission to jump ship, basically. So like when the Bulldogs were working for New Japan Company, Sakaguchi or Inoki would have to call Baba's company and say, listen, you know, are they free to work there? And if they do, you know, what are you going to pay them type deal? So it was the working agreement from a financial standpoint and contracts, you know, guys like it was the Bulldogs. I think Gordy was part of that at one point. Definitely Hanson, because Hanson worked for both companies. Butcher, for sure, worked both companies, probably Brody. But, I mean, a lot of those guys, I mean, there was you had to get permission from one company to get to jump ship.
To jump. Yeah. Oh, really?
So, I mean, they were allies, but at the same time, they worked together to make sure, you know, everything was done on the up and up.
Now, when you went, were All Japan tours longer than the New Japan? Was they 6 weeks sometimes?
Couple 6 weeks. New Japan was probably the longest I had was 4.
Mm-hmm.
And the one summer, I think me and Eddie did, like, back to back to back to back.
Did you just stay over there? Or did
No.
Okay.
No,
we
didn't.
Back, yeah.
We didn't.
How did you like basically living in Japan?
I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. You know, you've been there. It's feast or famine.
Yeah.
Either you love it or you hate it.
Right.
No, there's no middle ground. I never heard anybody say, well, I just put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the culture, it's a culture shock, number one. If you don't like the food, you're kind of screwed. I mean, you can only eat Mos Burgers so many times.
Yeah. That's a burger that comes out of a vending machine, by the way, guys.
Absolutely,
Mos Burger.
Absolutely rotten.
Yeah.
And, you kind of rent it. You don't buy it,
yeah.
If you know what I mean. But, it's a soy meat.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I loved it because they respected you for what you did,
mm-hmm.
good or bad. And there was, you know, they looked at wrestling right up there with, you know, it was like a blue-collar crowd.
Yeah.
You know?
They looked at wrestling like they would a football game or a hockey game here.
Yeah.
The results would be in the paper the next day.
Extremely respectful. They're very educated about holds and moves, and they kind of did their homework and knew what was going on.
Studying the matches as you're doing it. That's why it's very quiet, because they're watching everything you're doing.
Yeah.
And your style was perfect for that, because they love the counter holds and holds, the whole artistry of that.
Yeah, you get the oohs and the ahs.
Yeah.
But, a great place to work, and it taught me a lot about the business. It was a great beginning for me, great first step, wasn't traded for nothing.
Because, like I said, as a guy a few years behind you guys, that was always the holy grail. Like, if I could just make it to Japan, I always wanted to go, because of what was going on with New Japan,
right?
Specifically, because you could see this and go, all these guys are so good, and they're working the exact style that I like, and I want to go to Japan. So it was the same for me. When I went there, I didn't ever have any problems being there, although sometimes it's hard, but whatever. It's like, I'd rather be here than working, you know, in Rimby, Alberta, you know, 2 hours outside of Calgary. I don't want to do that. I'd rather be working, you know, out here.
Yeah, I still say it's today, and after being 15 years removed from the business from in-ring performing, the greatest times and the best times I ever had in the business was working in Japan, for sure.
Was it the freedom you had?
Not that I didn't enjoy
my
tenure here in the States with the three companies that I worked for, but definitely for sure in Japan.
Because of the freedom?
The freedom, the style. I could just go out and be me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to worry about anything. You know, if I wanted to wrestle for 5 minutes, for 6 minutes, if it ended up being for 20 minutes, and, you know,
yeah.
And the respect to the audience you had every single night.
Who was some of the really super popular gaijings when you were working over there between both companies? I mean, you talk about Hansen.
Hansen, of course, being right. Number one.
Most popular?
Probably,
Hansen?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just a huge star. I mean, I got to do several tours with Dick Byers, the Destroyer. It was one of the biggest first American guys that went over there was working with Ricky Dozan, when Ricky Dozan was one of the first big Japanese guys who was actually Korean. But Dick Byers is a huge name there.
Always wears his mask.
Always wears his mask.
No matter what.
And if you saw him without it, you would know the reason why. Kind of like La Parca, the first time I saw La Parca without his mask on.
Ugly.
Remember I thought La Parca meant horse face. Action.
Remember he scared Bobby Eaton?
Yeah.
He's like, man, this guy's looking at me.
Yeah.
He's looking at me. I'm scared of him.
but definitely Dick Byers, but probably way before Stan. But guys like Stan, Abdul the Butcher. I mean, anybody that was totally different from the culture of Japan. Butcher was totally different.
Interesting.
Definitely different. Anybody, you know, that's why Brody was such a big star there, I believe. You know, of course they like guys like myself or guys that could wrestle, but they're also, the other end of the spectrum was somebody that was totally different from the Japanese culture.
Right.
You know, Tiger Jitsang was another guy who was a big name.
Well, because you mentioned, it's a good point, because Japan's a very much a conformist society, and that everybody, they do the same thing. They look the same way when they go to work. They're wearing the same clothes.
Right.
Somebody comes in and just being, I remember guys would go, I remember a couple times even me. I mean, the first time with FFW, I saw Tarzan Goto punch a fan in the face. And the fan was like, got up, like smiling. Oh my God, like hurting.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I got punched in the face by Tarzan Goto. I was like, where the hell are we? You're allowed to do that?
Yeah.
You know, you can like run after people and they run away. They're scared. You know, I'd never seen anything like that before. Obviously, in our country, fans would just look at you and give you the bird. But
yeah,
I saw
Davey Boy Smith and Dynamite Kid having lunch one day. And outside the window was an intersection, and these two people kept bothering for an autograph, and David was getting a little perturbed because he wanted to be left alone. He picked the guy up, walked outside the building, pressed him over his head, and threw him in the middle of a four-way intersection. it was like, I'm just sitting looking through the window going, I wonder if I'm working with him tonight.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's borderline attempted murder.
Pretty much.
Right?
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's what you could pretty much get.
But the guy, the funny part to your point, the guy had a smile on his face.
Yeah.
He was press-slammed by David Boy Smith.
He'll tell him, Asai, Ultimo Dragon, would always talk about the time when, I think it was Tiger Jitsang, slapped him in the face when he was like 12.
Yeah.
And everyone in school thought I was so cool.
A lot of sadistic people over there.
Yeah, that really hit me, beat me. Yeah, smashed me in the face. Working over there, talking about the guys that you worked with, I mean, who did you enjoy working with the most over in Japan?
No, like really favorite. I mean, I just, part of the fun of working there too was it wasn't, you know, like here you might be on the loop with a guy and it's the same match every night for three nights or even for the month if you're kind of programmed with the guy. Over there it was the box of chocolates. Every night you never knew what you're going to get when you walked in the locker room, hence seeing the name of Hansen and Spivey right alongside the Malenko brothers.
Yeah.
But every night was a challenge, and that's part of the fun that I liked. I didn't like being complacent. I liked to always try to use my mind and thinking different things. And that was always fun about the Super Junior tournaments is that every night you had a different guy. And, you know, it was the best of the best.
You were always so good to work with, too, because you always had so many ideas. You know, you would just come in and say, let's do this, and they'd be like, okay. Like, it was, like, easy.
I always try to study the business. I always try to do different things every time I worked. Probably that's where the Man of a Thousand Holds kind of came into play. Mm-hmm. You know, if I knew I was working in Tampa, let's say, and I was back 6 months later, I kind of could remember the match. And try to do something different. Always to give the audience something different.
Yeah, you're always the guy too. Like I always said, I should write down all of, because you always knew this is where the gym is in this town.
Okay.
This is where the McDonald's is. This is what radio station you need to listen to.
Right.
This is where the tanning bed is, or whatever.
Right.
McDonald's in Japan, because McDonald's in Japan is like an oasis.
Oh, of course.
But you would remember all this stuff. Yeah. Like, how do you know? When was the last time you were here? Oh, about a year and a half ago.
My wife says I can't remember our anniversary, but I can remember stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is. You know.
Did you ever show up in New Japan one night? And like you mentioned, in All Japan one night you had Hansen.
Right.
Did you ever go to, you know, in New Japan to show up when you had Vader or had Muda? Or did they keep you guys pretty much sequestered with the other
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple times I did like six mans with Tony Holmes, and there's another night with Lex, which was me, Chris, and Lex. Another night it was me, Lex, and Tony Holmes. And Tony Holmes had three moves.
And that was Ludwig Borga.
Yeah,
was
Ludwig
his name.
Borga.
Yeah, yeah.
And all three of them were not very well done. And he was trying to tell me and Chris that for me to tag him in after we've already done our stuff, kind of make him the big star. So as he was in the middle of us and getting checked by the referee, I kind of like backed up a step and kind of looked at Chris and gave him the nod to walk out on the apron. And we kind of left Tony in the middle of the ring by himself, and the bell rang. And he looked back and like, thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, because he didn't have any spots planned.
No, well, he only had three moves, and once he used that up, he was kind of screwed.
Left,
yeah. So any time that he was circled around our area, we kind of would just step down off the ring apron.
Like a heel angle, but you're doing it for real.
Exactly. Things like that are fun that kind of keep your sanity going while you're there for 4 weeks.
Here's a question just from a professional standpoint, because I never really, like, I worked with Benoit many, many, many times and never really worked with Eddie too much. I mean, it did a little bit, but you worked extensively with both guys. Could you choose which guy you liked working with better? Well, obviously, they're different sides of the coin, but both of them are just tremendous performers, and you had great chemistry with both. Yeah.
Common denominator about those guys is they love the business. Mm-hmm. They're very passionate about the business and going out there and giving 110% and having the best match on the card. But the styles were a little different. You know, Chris was more of a hard nose, in your face, straightforward. Eddie could wrestle a little bit. Eddie actually had a little bit of an amateur background. And Eddie was, I think, a little more versatile than Chris was. Not that Chris was a bad
No,
worker
I can
at
understand,
all.
Yeah.
That's where they kind of, to me, is the major difference between both guys. I think I clicked better with Eddie. Not that I had bad matches with Chris, but from a standpoint of either one of those guys, I think I clicked better with Eddie. First time we ever worked was a semifinal match in Osaka in the junior heavyweight tournament. Never worked with each other and went out there and just had a great match. I think there was just, you know, it is sometimes you can get in the ring with a guy and you just either have chemistry with him or you don't.
Yeah.
And some guys you think you might have a chemistry, like Juventud Guerrero is one guy I thought, well, I had good matches with Ray, so I could have a good match with him. Wrong answer.
Really?
Yeah, we just
interesting.
Yeah, we just didn't click.
And like for me, I had great matches with Juve, almost as many as I did with Ray.
Yeah, sometimes it's just, you know, it is. And there's no answer for it. There's no way to really correct the problem. It's just
the way it is. I never had good matches with Kanemoto.
Yeah.
Ever. Really? And I did you?
No, not really.
See, I talked to TJ Wilson. He said he loved working with Kanemoto. Yeah. They always said, I could never crack the code with him.
Right.
You know?
Right. And then some guys you look forward to, like the first time I worked with Dragon. So, you know, I said, there's a guy that kind of, he's very well-rounded.
Yeah, he was a great worker. Yeah, I loved working
with him. He could do it all.
You know,
Mexican style, the Japanese style, he could mat wrestle a little bit.
Yeah, he was a little more, once again, the difference between Chris and Eddie was the difference between Asai, Dragon, and Liger.
Right.
Was Liger was a little bit more hard-nosed, and Asai was a little bit more, I don't know, flamboyant's the word, a little more graceful. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know?
Yeah.
You can see the differences there. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
No, Eddie was fun to work with. He really was.
Yeah.
Chemistry with him.
He always, he would, actually both those guys, if there was a mistake or something, they would take it very seriously and take it very to heart.
Oh, almost to the point.
Too much.
Too much.
Yeah. Yeah. I know Chris would.
Then you don't start enjoying the business, or the fruits of your labor.
Yeah, and that's part of it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I went and saw the Stones last night, and during Happy, Keith Richards totally forgot what the hell he was doing. There was no idea what was going on. You could tell, like, it was a total train wreck, but it happens, and who cares?
Right.
If that happened, if you missed a spot or something with Chris, he'd go hide in a, you know, dark corner, and Eddie would be so beating himself up, and it was my fault. It's like, who cares?
The posture was bad enough, but it got even worse. And only you would probably know what I'm talking about.
That's exactly right, man, exactly right. Last question, man. There's so much we could talk about, like I said, though, but we can save our experiences and kind of more of that for the next time, but what... Two questions. First of all, if you had to pick your favorite match from that era of working in Japan, does one pop in your head? Is there a couple that pop in your head?
Well, one night that was real interesting. It was second time they've ever done this was Brothers versus Brothers. I actually worked my brother for the Junior Heavyweight Championship in Sapporo.
How was that?
And the only other time that ever happened was Terry worked Dory.
Oh.
Which was funny because then we did a tag tour. And it was Brothers versus Brothers tour. So me and my brother got to work with Terry and Dory 3 weeks straight every single night.
Malenko's versus Funks.
Yeah, Malenko's versus Funks. Now, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
How were they to work with?
They were. It was funny. As a kid growing up and watching Dory Funk Jr. wrestle at Fort Hesley Army, watching him go an hour with Jack Briscoe and Gene Kaninsky, and I used to watch that European uppercut, and I'd say, God, he does that great. Until the first time I actually took it, and I'm saying, now I know why it looks so darn good.
Because it's real.
It's real, and my boots fell off my feet. But, those guys were just, I mean, they were to the latter part of their career, but they were a lot of fun, especially working with Terry. He's all over the place, but
he was a little more rambunctious than Dory, right?
Oh yeah, and he, you know, anybody that's younger in the ring than him, he wanted to try to keep up with him,
mm-hmm.
which made it fun every night.
I'll never forget when I saw him do his first moonsault in Knoxville, Tennessee, at a Smoky Mountain Wrestling show in '94.
Mm.
I was like, "There's no way," because he was like 50 then. I don't know how old, 55 or something.
Right.
There's no way he's gonna do that. Come on, someone's gonna stop him. And Room does this weird loping, strange praying mantis moonsault, but it was like he didn't have to do that. He's Terry Funk. He's over.
Right.
But he did it because he wanted to push himself.
Of course.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Probably the answer to your question. It'd probably have to be the Bulldogs.
Really? Yeah.
Only because it was the tag match of the year.
Yeah.
And again, it's not like things that are voted here, like Bill Lapter votes on it, who's been in the ring once.
Yeah,
never.
Yeah.
And it
was voted tag match of the year, like in the Japanese press?
Yeah, back in 1988.
Wow.
And that's a big deal over there because, again, everything's so respected and they look at things.
No, it's real. It's like winning, you know, the MVP of the NFL or something. It's a real deal.
And just working with those two guys and knowing their backgrounds and the popularity that Dynamite had all those years working with Tiger Mask and the, you know, where those guys have come from. So that was a real fun night. And it was at Corican Hall, which is a small building, as you know, but it's just there's just so much history there and, you know, so
it's like
stories.
You know, as critically acclaimed as the ECW Arena would be here, for example, the Corican Hall.
Sure.
And talking about bringing it back to Tampa, such a huge tradition of all these great performers. Who's the most popular wrestler, do you think, in Florida Championship Wrestling history?
It'd have to be Eddie and my dad.
Because, really?
Well, the 15-year feud.
Yeah.
Even, you know, you'd have to be around at that time, probably late 60s, all through the 70s. So a lot of the younger generation now wouldn't know who the great Malenko was.
Right.
Probably you were the last one to bring that up.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody that's lived in this area for more than 30, 40 years that kind of grew up in Tampa, you say the great Malenko and they know exactly who it is right away. You know, back then those guys were – those were the stars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was, like I said, there was no football, there was no hockey. There was
everyone in town knew them.
Yeah, and they were very recognizable. They were all over the place. And, yeah, the Grand Malenko feud, you know, 15 years, a long, long investment.
Mm. So when can we see the – when do you think we're going to be able to see the Hall of Fame wall?
I'm not sure exactly when the building's going to be finished. I know they started on the roof. And I think they said it's going to take a couple of years to.
Okay, so this is going to be a long process,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but I've seen the draft of what it's supposed to look like. It's supposed to really look real nice. And there's a part of it that's a little sad to me and my brother. You know, it's a place that we grew up as kids, and you see it torn down. But I think, you know, my dad died at a pretty young age, and my kids never got the chance to meet my dad, so it's a great legacy
to see his name
on a wall or his picture.
Sure.
And all the guys, for that matter, that would spend time here. And
how much that building meant, like you mentioned, like it was almost like the Sportatorium in Dallas. You always
have
the famous Sportatorium.
Yep.
Or even like the Hart House. It doesn't exist anymore. There's
these
local monuments that mean everything to a whole world of fans.
Well, of course. Well, it's the mom and pop shop.
Yeah.
And they're all closing up and everything's become corporate. And
that's right.
It's bigger.
But once it comes up, it's going to be a tourist destination for all hardcore wrestling fans.
And some for everybody that grew up in Tampa and you know, to be proud of.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. What did you say to Brian Knobs when he was wearing his underwear that one time? You remember? He said, that's not a G-string, that's the whole alphabet.
That's all alphabet, right?
Thanks to Dean Malenko for the great conversation. Thanks to CeCe and Shai. Make sure you check out their YouTube channel. And once again, I'm sure Dean and I need to do a second part talking all about WCW, and we will do that. But I want to thank him for being here. Thanks to you guys for downloading Talk Is Jericho twice a week and supporting all my sponsors, including Amazon, who's been supporting this show since the very first episode. We're at episode, I think, 227, and they've been doing it since number one. Very cool. Amazon's the easiest way to support Talk Is Jericho. Amazon's a great place for music. Get the new Anthrax album, For All Kings, and go check out Beatles Bonanti, Charlie Bonanti and I talking about the Beatles, or the new Megadeth record, Dystopia. That's Dave Mustaine was on a few weeks ago talking about that. Who gets the biggest rock and roll guests? I do, and I want you to support my friends, my guests, by using the Talk Is Jericho links to pick up their records. Make that Amazon purchase. Go find my links. Go to podcast1.com. Click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. I got Amazon links for USA, UK, Canada, A. Every time you use them links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover production costs. No extra fees or hidden charges. Just go buy whatever you want on Amazon, and don't forget, tweet me a picture of what you buy on Amazon, and I will follow you you back on Twitter, and I'll retweet it. I'll get my Amazon warriors going. Take a picture of what you buy. Tweet it at Talk Is Jericho. I will retweet it and follow you because you rock. All right. So thanks again to podcast1.com. The Killer Deals button, top right corner of the page. Hit the Talk Is Jericho button. Go buy some stuff on Amazon. And all my sponsors are there too. My amazing sponsors, DDP Yoga. DDP Yoga Now app. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. Then there's nuts.com. Use my promo code Jericho to get 4 free samples. DraftKings.com. Use my promo code Y2J to play for free. Geico. So many others. I appreciate you listening today. Keep listening for the 60-second news update. AP News headlines coming up next. Stay hard. Stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. And we'll see you next Wednesday for the return of, I know you guys are always excited to hear my paranormal shows. I went all the way to the Pacific Northwest, Portland, Oregon, to talk to Wes Germer, who has the number one podcast, one of the authorities on Sasquatches and unidentified creatures in the Pacific Northwest. His show is called The Sasquatch Chronicles. Like I said, it's one of the biggest shows in the world today, discussing all things Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yetis. He had an encounter with his brother Woody that set off this amazing chain of events. And what a story he has. Wes Germer from the Sasquatch Chronicles will be here on Wednesday, back in the paranormal world. I know you guys are digging that. We'll see you then. Stay hard, stay hungry, stay cool, be safe. It's love and hugs and a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.